got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I got a broken thing.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast. I'm your co-host, Cameron English.
And I'm the other co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor and science communicator who has a passion to help teach you about science.
We've got a fresh batch of stories for you guys from the world of genetics and biotechnology. First up, a diverse group of drugs could stop would-be superbugs from developing antibiotic resistance. Biosimilar medicines could drastically cut healthcare costs and expand access to prescription drugs for millions of people. And it turns out consumers will eat gene-edited food if they know about all of its benefits. And finally, plant biosensors may be able to detect flu viruses and crop pests before they become global problems. And in fact, they might even be able to filter certain toxins out of indoor environments. So Kevin, let's get into this. I think these are all really cool stories, starting with literally stopping evolution to treat superbugs. So tell us about this story in Live Science.
Yeah, I absolutely love this story and the foundational paper that it comes from. It's one of my favorite papers in a long time. So it goes back to the idea that there are more and more diseases that are becoming multi-drug resistant. And when you start speaking about pneumonia, like ideally the one caused by Streptococcus pneumoniae, so Streptococcus, pneumococcus, we can say as kind of a catch-all phrase, this bug goes about its life figuring out how to become resistant to the drugs that we use to control it. So it's a lot like us kind of learning a new skill. Okay, so like remember Gilligan's Island? So Gilligan would be walking down, you know, wherever and get hit in the head with a coconut. And all of a sudden he was smarter than the professor, right? He gained this new ability and new skill simply from something that came from the environment. And then he'd get hit in the head and he was back to normal. It was a case of environmental influence creating competence. And that's what happens in bacteria. And it's really cool. Streptococcus, Haemophilus, there's a series of bacteria that do this. They get this new skill of resistance by taking up DNA from the environment. So in their environment, in biology, there's DNA floating all over the place from the breakdown of other bacteria and the death of other bacteria. These bacteria, like Streptococcus, can scavenge that DNA and stick it into their own genomes. And all of our bacterial antibiotic resistance genes originated from bacteria. They're the way that bacteria fought fungus and everything else. So this is a way that a bacterium can pick from its environment to incorporate a gene that it finds useful in creating more bacteria.
Yeah, this is fascinating stuff. And I say that every week, but it really is true that there's the stuff that's going on. So this is a really big deal because according to the story anyway, almost 3 million people catch one of these superbugs every year. And so if you're laying in a hospital bed and they don't have a medicine to treat you, this is a major development.
Well, especially because pneumococcus causes hundreds of thousands of deaths every year. And this would be a really public health threat if there was widespread resistance above what there is. We still have some drugs to control this, and there's still possibilities to do that. But the strategy for this approach is really pretty cool. It's not to poison the bacterium. It's to protect the drug that is working on the bacteria. A little bit different approach.
Yeah, well, what was so interesting to me is they actually said, we don't want to disrupt the replication of this bacteria or kill it. We actually just want to preserve the drug, like you said. I thought that was really interesting because when people think of a disease or you know, some kind of a microbe that is harmful, it's like, we want to kill it, but that's not what they're trying to do. They're just trying to preserve the drug. So tell us a little more about that aspect of it.
Yeah, well, this work was done by Jan Willem Vierning, a professor who's in Department of Fundamental Microbiology at the Swiss University of Lausanne. And what the idea was is that this idea of bacteria becoming competent, the state where they could absorb DNA from the environment, happens because of something called competence-stimulating peptide, or CSP. And this is part of what's called bacterial quorum sensing. So bacteria have a really cool mechanism that in order to have a good infection, you have to all be on the same page as bacteria. You know, you're not going to do it as one microscopic bacterium, but if you got a big bunch of you who are coordinated and doing the same sort of pathogenic gene expression, you have a shot at causing some trouble. So this quorum sensing is part of it. They push this peptide out of the bacterial cell, which then binds receptors and other bacteria. And when there's enough of this quorum sensing peptide, you have the competence for absorbing DNA from the environment and causing infection. So these things kind of go hand in hand. But this is when bacteria are able to take it up. So are there ways that you can stop the extrusion of a competence stimulating peptide? And what they know is that there's this thing that happens ahead of time, and I don't want to get too much in the weeds here, but there's the creation of a proton gradient, meaning the charged protons that are sequestered on one side of a membrane or another that creates an electromotive force. It creates a chemical gradient that now when they flow from one side to the other can drive some sort of process, like water flowing over a a windmill, but what's the thing in the water that goes like a sawmill, you know, or a sugar mill, like where the water is drive, or a dam, you know, a turbine. Yeah, so the water is flowing, in this case protons are flowing and work is being done that then pushes out the peptide, the CSP peptide that induces the ability to take up DNA. So that's the trick to this.
Now, they didn't use anything new to do this. That was also very interesting to me. They were using a variety of drugs. So I think some of them were antipsychotic drugs. Others were antifungal drugs. They all used the same mechanism, from what I understand, to achieve this. But it wasn't some new medicine they're developing. Tell us a little bit about that, Kevin.
Well, this is super cool. So what they did was they took the bacteria that can become competent, and they hooked up a firefly luciferase gene. So this is the gene that makes a firefly glow, you know, yellow green. They put this into the bacterium downstream from the control region of the extrusion of that peptide. So what it means is that when the conditions were correct for the bacteria to become competent to take up DNA, they would glow orange and green. And what this group did was take those bacteria and drive them to that position where they're starting to become orange-green and treat them with chemicals. There are 1,286 different medications that they used, and these are all FDA approved, used in human beings, whatever, and tested them to see if they could disrupt the process. And what they found was that there were 46 drugs, and as you mentioned, antipsychotics, antimalarials, that all affected this proton motive force, that affected the ability of this thing to push protons and give the bacteria the ability to take up foreign DNA. So this is really cool, because now you have drugs that are already approved. You don't have to go through that process. And those drugs can now protect antibiotics from becoming obsolete because the bacteria are less likely to evolve around them. It's a pretty neat approach.
Yeah, well, it seems like it's even beyond the way we normally think of approving drugs. And that's one thing I was going to ask you about is, would they just repurpose these medicines for this, or would they try to develop something new that just has this particular quality that they want?
Well, what it means is that you would use the same drugs for a different indication, which is a lot different than starting from the beginning and proving safety and efficacy. That's already been demonstrated. So what's so cool about this is that you now have 46 drugs that you can administer, you know, one or however many, along with an antibiotic regimen that would protect that antibiotic from becoming obsolete in those bacteria. But the research they did was even cooler. So let me just go a little bit further here. They then tested this in mice. They showed that that worked, which is really cool. But the neat part is in the bacteria. So let's go back to the bacteria. They're glowing yellow when they're ready to become competent to take up foreign DNA. Okay. And so you give the drug, they don't turn yellow, meaning they haven't achieved that competence. So here's a case that if you have them glow, you give them the drug, they stop glowing, they can't take up DNA. Then you give them the CSP peptide, meaning that now that they're seeing the peptide that you apply rather than the one that comes from the bacterium, it now starts taking up DNA, meaning that you found a way to use the signal that induces DNA uptake in bacteria that have been disabled from uptaking it with a drug. Meaning, so it just shows that it's specifically affecting the release of the peptide from within the cell, that when you give the peptide, everything is normal. It's really cool. And I think it's a really neat approach to helping ensure that the future will have antibiotics that are useful against really nasty diseases.
Yeah, absolutely. And I believe this is one of many approaches. So I think some research groups are trying to use CRISPR to actually disable that this feature in certain bacteria so they no longer are resistant, I think. And there's also people trying to develop new antibiotics, and then there's this approach. There's probably others too. But the point is that there's a multi-pronged strategy to preserve these medicines and add more that keep us healthy when we get sick.
No, that's perfect. It's that multifaceted approach that ultimately we'll adopt in terms of the maintenance of antibiotic efficacy. And, no big surprise. We're seeing the same thing in agriculture. We're seeing the same thing in medicine. It's there's no one magic bullet.
Yeah. Hey, parenthetically, just before we move on, would this be an example of like a quote unquote natural GMO where you see these organisms exchanging DNA?
Well, it's a good example. It's horizontal gene transfer, right?
Right.
You're taking genes that are just in, the milieu of weirdness of within the lungs or within the gastrointestinal tract. Bacteria die all the time. And what happens to their biomolecules is that they're either broken down by some mechanism or in this case assimilated into other bacteria. So it is a horizontal gene transfer.
Interesting. Well, another example to bring up with maybe some of your skeptical friends, but let's move on to this next story. And this is about biosimilar drugs, Kevin. So I don't know if most people know what that is. So tell us first, let's start with what are biologics and what are biosimilars and yeah, give us that first off.
So biologics are this relative, well, I shouldn't say new class of drugs. Vaccines are technically biologics. They're types of drugs that are developed through organisms. So vaccines and eggs, different components of blood, so different clotting agents, drugs used in gene therapy, monoclonal antibodies. These are all things that either come from animal cells, from animals themselves, yeast, microbes, all these different ways to do it. And these are drugs that are really the front line on different kinds of aggressive cancers, autoimmune disease like Crohn's and arthritis. You see all these drugs on TV. I wish I could remember the names of the brand names of some of them right off the top of my head. But these, any of the ones that end in AB, this is some of the drugs that are coming out that are biologics and pretty cool stuff and really effective.
Now, biosimilars are, I believe the phrase they use or the FDA uses is clinically equivalent or clinically not identical, but it's pretty close basically. So these biosimilars are basically generic versions of these medicines. And so this has the effect of creating more competition in the marketplace, which tends to push down prices and gives normal people like you and me more access to more medicines, which of course, right, everyone says it's a good idea.
Well, let me just clarify one really quick thing, because you mentioned the word generic. You know, generics are the versions of drugs that are made that are the identical to the reference drug. So that's what they usually call the first one, the reference compound or the reference whatever. And biologics, or the generic, is the same thing, just made off-brand. These biosimilars are not identical to the reference compound. They're similar. And so this, you can imagine the legal battles this causes, because they do the same thing, but are slightly different. And so different companies have been making these biosimilar drugs, which come through biological organisms, that aren't quite the same. And you still have to have pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic properties that studied. You have to do all those analyses. But when you do them, you find out that compound A and compound B are really doing the same thing, even though they're different.
Right.
And back in 2010, President Obama approved the Biologics Price Comparison Act, Price Competition and Innovation Act. And the idea was to bring down the prices by allowing competition in the new space of biologics.
Very interesting. And just for clarity, so when most people think of a pharmaceutical drug, they're thinking of something that's chemically synthesized, which is a different category, right? Just to make sure we're all clear on what we're talking about here.
Right. These are using biology to synthesize them typically. And that's kind of the difference here. And it's an amazing market that's really only gaining steam, because it's, I think back in 2014, most of the drugs that were the biggest in sales were biologics. And the similars are also selling very well, but only at about 10 to 40% of the brand name drug. And there are estimates, like by the RAND Corporation and other places, that say biosimilars could bring in as much as or could save insurance providers $54 billion over the next few years. So this is a really big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's such a big number. I don't know if people can process it, myself included. You know, I mean, $54 million is so much. But there were a couple things about the story that stood out to me. So the first one is that a lot of they call them innovator companies that originally designed these medicines, they're actually putting out misinformation about biosimilars, which I thought was very fascinating, that they're actually, in certain ways, trying to discourage this. So give us your take on that. What do you think is going on there?
Yeah, so this is really an interesting example of the turf wars within the pharmaceutical industry, because these are all big players. So you have Pfizer, Genentech, all the Sandoz. All these are big companies that come out with their flagship compound, and everybody else goes and makes something that's biosimilar and is allowable. And so you can see the problem that's caused there. But a lot of these companies have really engaged in fear, uncertainty, and doubt, particularly with healthcare providers who don't necessarily understand the biosimilar concept. It was shown in surveys. But the other thing on this is that providers are hesitant to recommend a similar drug that hasn't gone through the same rigorous evaluation as the original flagship compound.
Yeah, and that was fascinating to me too, because I think most people probably trust their physicians, and I certainly do, of course, but the fact that even they don't know the ins and outs of this concept is actually very fascinating. So what's the significance on that? To me, it sounds like it's just such a new thing that it takes time for people to learn about it and really adopt it into the way they treat their patients. Is that a fair assessment, would you say, Kevin?
Well, sure. I think what you're seeing is confusion on the side of three different P's: providers, payers, and patients, right? You have providers that are unsure if the biosimilar is going to give the same efficacy as the original compound. You have payers who are excited to take on a lower cost medicine, but the statistics show they're not necessarily adopting them, even though they would save money for insurance companies. And then you have patients who are saying, well, wait a minute, you know, this is a pretty serious disease. Why am I going with this class B compound that hasn't been as rigorously tested? And so it's a really interesting question. I think it ultimately benefits the delivery of healthcare, especially to those with who have lower means or less means, fewer means, but also maybe being able to get the newest technologies to more people. That's not such a bad thing.
Yeah, without a doubt. So, and this is an interesting transition. So speaking of, you know, you know, consumer opinion and widespread adoption of new technologies, there was a survey just put out by the Food Marketing Institute that looked at public perception of gene edited food. And there's a number of things that were real fascinating about this, Kevin, but I think the biggest one is that they found that consumers would eat gene edited food if they understood the benefits of it, namely for animal health and for human health and then for the environment. So let's break those down a little bit. Tell me about what's your biggest takeaway from this?
Yeah, this was a really interesting and very in-depth study that if you go online to the FMI, they will show you can download this for free, and it's a study that was sponsored by the American Seed Trade Association, the American Farm Bureau Federation, the Farm Foundation. And what they showed in this study was they surveyed 4,487 U.S. food shoppers and gave them a survey. And the survey said terms like organic, non-GMO, bioengineered, conventional, gene edited. They gave them all these different terms and different prices for different items. And what you found were some of the usual trends, that people were willing to pay more for organic food. They said they thought it was more expensive, but healthier and safer. We hear that all the time. You also saw a lower willingness to pay for gene edited food. So they, just off the top, people weren't too excited about that because it's genes and that means DNA. And, you know, that means, monkeying with genetics. So that was the problem. And 50% of people in the study had no idea what it meant. They just know they didn't like it.
So now this tended to improve when you told people, and just to use an example from the animal world, you know, if you can prevent having to like physically pull horns off a cow, if you can edit the DNA so it's not born with horns, that's a real demonstrable benefit for animal welfare. And of course, I think that really resonates with people. So as you tell people how this technology benefits them and benefits other people, of course, but animals and then the environment, they start to go, oh, I get it, even if they didn't know that much about it initially. So what's your takeaway from that?
Well, it really reinforces what we've learned in the last two decades of science communication, is that the facts don't matter. It's not about the nuts and bolts of safety and risk and, you know, LD50s and all that stuff. Consumers don't care. Consumers just want to know that it's an approach that benefits some aspect of something they care about, whether it's the environment, human health, maybe availability. When it really gets down to brass tacks, humans care about price and they care about quality, like flavor and that kind of thing. And they're not so worried about how things are produced. If it was, you know, genetic engineering or organic or conventional, they don't even know what that stuff means in reality. So the bottom line is that consumers are willing to make these purchases if they understand the rationale of why they were used. And so as people engaged in science communication, as we speak to people, we should talk about why the technology is important. And that's the way we win their hearts.
Yeah, that's very fascinating. And it actually reminds me of working in sales before I started doing this science communication thing full time. It really comes down to making sure you understand making sure you understand people's concerns and then addressing them. And it sounds very simple in principle, but you know, day to day, I'm sure it's a little more challenging, but it's still nonetheless a very important concept to keep in mind.
Well, it's what Aristotle and others have taught us for ages, is that, you know, you dig a hole and then fill it, you know, create a need and then show how you satisfy that need. And that good persuasion really, and, you know, and this is some of my background showing through here, that good persuasion has those elements of helping identify the need that people have and then showing how your product satisfies it. It goes back to if you Google Monroe's motivated sequence, psychologist from the 60s who was studying how people behave, every infomercial does this. And for some reason, we as scientists figured that the facts and the evidence would always win, and we turned out we were horribly wrong.
Yeah. Well, but I think the the silver lining, if you will, is that people are starting to understand that now. And I think this is what the survey shows. And it's what we've seen in medicine too. And maybe you can comment on this because you have more expertise, but in the biomedical world, there isn't that much concern about, you know, a genetically engineered vaccine, for example, because it just works and people can see the tangible results of that. So maybe that's the way that we need to go in the food and agricultural world, is just to stress, you know, what this actually does for you.
Well, that's partially it. I also think that it's because when you talk about medicine and you're discussing a therapy with somebody, you're speaking to their cognition, you're speaking to their executive function, their cerebral cortex. It makes sense. You can, you know, connect the dots with facts and information to satisfy what they need to know. When you're talking about food, you're talking to the reptile part of the brain and, you know, that first level of the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, and it's very different. And so I think if you're using technology in medicine, people feel hope. If you're using technology in food, people feel fear and skepticism. You know, they have plenty of food in this country. We got it all. And that's the other side, is the scarcity. We have plenty of food, so we're not worried. We don't want technology to touch it. We need better health, so we want technology to touch it. So that's how I think about those things. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, never mind that technology has touched our food forever, but maybe that's your point, is that we don't need to dwell on stuff like that because people are not really interested. But anyways, nonetheless, very fascinating survey, gives us some guidance moving forward. So moving on, this is our final story. So Kevin, what in God's name is a synthetic biosensor? Because most people don't know what that term is. So introduce us. This is from Rachel Munez at Lab Manager.
Yeah, I love this. Well, because, you know, plants are stuck in one place. You can't get up and walk away from stress. You can't go walk over and find some water. You can't get out of the heat. You're stuck in one place and you got a deal. And so plants have elaborate mechanisms to sense their environment, their proximity to neighbors, their competitors. And plants are very good at understanding their environment. And they're like little computers. They got little sensors all over them that are taking the information from the external environment and shaping their growth and development to best accommodate that environment. So scientists have been interested in this for a little while, as to how can you use the plant and that really interesting computer and integration to sense compounds from the environment that the plant never had to sense, but that we want it to sense. And going back to the early 2000s, they started to use plants to detect things like TNT, like landmines. You could put the seeds out on the ground and then see where the landmines were, because the plants would turn a funny color. Or, you know, this is the idea of using plants, which can have very, very sensitive sensors to environmental cues. So that's really the basis of this.
Yeah. And they didn't actually use that example in the story, but I actually thought of that one too, because when I first heard that story, I thought, man, this is so cool that you can do that with plants. So tell us a little more about that, because they took a gene from a bacterium that can metabolize TNT, and then they took either a promoter or a gene from a jellyfish. And so when the plant grows in a field where there might be a landmine, it detects the TNT and then it fluoresces green or red. Just the coolest thing. So can you break that down a little bit on the genetic side?
Well, that would be one approach. But the ones that they've done mostly result in a color change in the plant, like a visible color change. And so the purple pigments in plants are called anthocyanins, and they're induced by a variety of different environmental inputs. And so if you hook up the control region of one of the limiting steps in anthocyanin synthase, like these genes called chalcone synthase, chalcone isomerase, all these upstream genes, if you open the floodgates on those, you can cause a plant to turn purple. And let's say you have a normally green plant with white flowers, you can have these plants out in the field that when they detect an environmental stimulus, turn purple. And we've been very interested in them from the strawberry side in my work. Could we put plants out in the field that were sensitive to pathogens, that when there's pathogen attack, that plants on the end of the row who are more susceptible to the pathogen might turn purple before the crop plant. And this would tell us, okay, it's time for you to spray or to treat for some sort of pathogen presence. The concept was called sentry plants, S-E-N-T-R-Y, sentry, not like sentry plant, like a, you know, tequila plant, but that was the idea. And there's some really cool ones. There's ones that I actually had it on my podcast where they sense and remediate things like formaldehyde in indoor environments or military toxins like RDX. And there's these huge ranges that have been used in military drills since the early 1900s that are chock full of toxic chemicals. And these plants can not only sense them, they can remediate them and turn them into benign compounds that go back into the earth.
Yeah. So they actually either, I forget the terms they use, but they more or less break down the toxic substance into something that can't hurt you, right?
Right. That's the way they've been doing this. And I neglected to say that this is in, and I have to give a pat on the back to the University of Tennessee's Center for Agricultural Synthetic Biology. These folks are doing what I proposed that we do about 5 years ago. They are really digging into the idea of synthetic biology and plants. And they're using plants as very sensitive biosensors to solve really important questions.
Yeah. Now, before we wrap it up here, there was one really cool example, and I think it's topical given the concern about coronavirus that everybody has now. They can actually, I think, engineer plants to detect flu viruses. So tell us more about that if you have any more insight on it.
No, sure. They're looking at things like flu viruses, MRSA. All of the different viruses have discrete protein signatures on their outside membranes. And so you can engineer a cell to detect it like a lock and key. So that's how a flu virus enters the cell, is by first grabbing onto the cell and making some sort of handshake molecularly. So could we put that handshake we put the one hand into plants and the other hand on the virus, where they make that handshake and now the plant says, hey, we got a problem. And maybe next time you're walking through the halls at the hospital and you see the purple plants in one hallway and the green plants in another, it's telling you that maybe you ought to use a little extra blob of Purell and get out.
Yeah. You know what's interesting? Because we're talking about social isolation and trying to avoid big crowds with COVID-19 floating around. That might be an interesting way to do that, is if you can set up plants in areas where you suspect the virus is floating around, then that may be a signal to people that say, hey, stay away from here unless you need medical treatment, because this is, this is not safe for most people. So there's all kinds of applications is what I'm getting at.
Well, to tie this in a really nice bow, it may be a signal that you need to go back to some of those compounds that stop the evolution of bacteria and the uptake from their environment. That maybe they say, okay, we have a pathogen in this area, which has the capacity to evolve quickly around antibiotic regimens. And so maybe we better be co-administering some of these other compounds in order to ensure the efficacy of that antibiotic. And so it all works, because plants are like a little computer. You have ways of putting information in and you can get responses out. And so this is just a way of us being able to engineer the input and connect it to some sort of output through the biology of a plant. Super cool.
And that's why you all listen to this podcast, is not only do we tell you about the news, but we tie it all together and give you a better understanding. Mostly Kevin. I just ask the questions.
No, it's really cool, because we live at such a wonderful, wonderful time to explore the science. And I just love the ability to dig deep into some of these topics and really go back and look at some of the basic research that went into them. And it really makes me appreciate the beautiful work that's being done by so many great groups around the world right now. So this is really a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, I'm having such a good time with these conversations. I think we should do it next week at the same time.
Yep, I'm here.
All right, guys. Well, that's going to do it for us on the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast. As always, you can get the episodes for free at geneticliteracyproject.org. And very soon we'll be on iTunes and Spotify. And you can also find both of us on Twitter. Kevin, what's your handle if people want to follow you?
Sure. I'm at Kevin Folta, K-E-V-I-N-F-O-L-T-A, and also run the Talking Biotech podcast every Saturday morning.
Yeah, check out Talking Biotech. I always listen to it, and I've learned a bunch from it. So that's going to do it for us. Thank you guys so much. We'll see you next week.